Welcome back, everybody, to another bonus episode of The Devil Within. Hope you enjoyed this new season, A Season in Hell, chronicling the murder spree of David Berkowitz in New York in the late 70s. We have a special guest with us today. You probably won't actually recognize his voice because he kind of disappeared into vocal exercise of a madman. But with us is John Chiascaridis. John is an actor. He's an athlete. He's a producer, podcast host, a fitness motivational YouTuber, and a writer. But to call him an actor kind of sells that short a little bit because anybody who's ever done a play and been on stage, that's a different level of acting that requires a big set of balls. And John has theater credits from East Coast to West Coast. And he, most importantly, he hails from the fighting borough of Brooklyn, New York. And we're lucky to have him today. So John Chiascaridis, welcome to the show.
Man, Brandon, thank you for having me. That's a long list of. I feel humbled off of that list you read off of. But I'm excited, man. Yeah, and you're right. Theater definitely scares the crap out of me, but I love it. It's such a clean medium of just, you know, undisturbed presence where you're just out there, and if things go wrong, you just got to figure it out. So keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, definitely. So are you still because I know you're very committed to your craft as an actor, that you've been training for years. Is that an ongoing process?
It's always an ongoing process. Mm. I mean, I think the main thing that I learned as I transitioned, you know, obviously transitioning from LA to New York, it just really taught me about choice. And that's the main thing I've always focused on. So, I mean, I'm always thinking of things, you know, whether it be something I want to create or something I want to work on. I'm always an advocate of never, you know, always staying hungry, you know, and always wanting to succeed in whatever you're wanting to do as far as the next job or the next creation or the next, you know, show. But yeah, it goes like that always. My mind's always thinking, and I think that's what keeps me on my toes.
Had you done any voice acting before this?
Before this, I had done, it was like, I remember coming out of school, I went to William Esper on the East Coast. And after I finished that program, one of the actors, that's my friend, he's like, hey, you want to do this? And it was just a voiceover of like a grown man, you know, that wasn't going to be shown. And that's the only experience I've had prior to that. So I was pretty nervous when you're like, hey, you want to do this? But I knew the level of the project that was going to be out there. And I knew that it was going to be something meaty and something hard. And so that's why I was like, yes, let me go after this.
So tell me about that. When I called you up and said, yo, this is what I'm doing. And listen, you're from New York. Obviously you knew of David Berkowitz, but like, you're also much younger than me. Okay. And I don't remember. I was 2 years old when he was doing it. So you weren't even born yet.
I didn't exist.
Right. You didn't exist. So what I'm saying, the question would be like from your parents or from older people in your family, did they have remembrances? Were they in Brooklyn at the time? Were they, you know, around in the 70s then, that where you had any kind of knowledge of the Son of Sam crime spree when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of ingrained in the area I grew up in because I bounced around different parts of Brooklyn. I grew up where the Barclay Center is before that. So generally, I'd hear these stories from my mom. Because she was a, you know, a young, attractive woman. She was also dating around that time. And she was, in her late teens, you know, maybe early 20s. And so I would hear stories from her about how horrifying it was.
Is your mom Italian?
She's fully Italian. Yeah, fully Italian.
She had dark hair?
She's the quintessential target. You know, she had dark hair, brown eyes. And, you know, at that time when she was dating, you know, she met my dad around, I think, the 70s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were pretty terrified to go out there, and knowing my dad, he is this, you know, tough New Yorker from Greece. And, you know, he was even scared, you know, it was pretty crazy actually.
Yeah. That was a lot of the sentiments that I kind of found from people who were around back then was even for like tough New Yorkers, like your father, it was scared because the random nature of it and how long it lasted. You know, 13 months, and there was no rhyme or reason. No one knew what was motivating this guy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that terrified me when I was digging into this kind of stuff, is that I was looking at what it would be like in those shoes at that time, and how would I feel? Because, I mean, even researching a lot of this stuff of where he would commit these acts, I swear to you, I would go by this as an adult now, growing up in the same area, but this is like, what, 20 or 25 years later, but it's the same streets and the same, you know, overpasses looking the Verrazano Bridge and this beautiful landscape. And I'm like, every time I pass there, my mom or dad would be like, yeah, that's where the Son of Sam was.
Bath Beach out by Coney is where his last thing was, right there by the water.
Yeah, and Coney Island is a thing you do in the summer. I mean, it still kind of is. You know, it's a historical landmark.
Yeah.
And my uncle would take me on the Wonder Wheel all the time and the Cyclone. It's part of that essence of that I love about Brooklyn. But yeah, you would go there all the time, and Nathan's Famous is there. And
right.
To think of these things going on at the same time is, I don't know, I'd be a horrified teenager. I probably wouldn't want to go outside, and I consider myself semi-tough, I think.
Sure, of course, but you're not tougher than a gun to your head, right?
No, I don't think anyone is,
no.
Especially that type of, even researching that caliber of weapon, it's so accurate, you know, and it's so devastating.
Yeah.
You know, that it's something that you don't want to be in the presence of at all, because your chances are very, very low.
And just the sudden explosion of violence. That's what I, as a writer, when I was researching it before I actually got into the writing of it, I was a little concerned about the repetitive nature of the attacks and how to make that interesting or scary or new in every episode, because he did the same thing almost every time, walk up to a car from behind and shoot through the window. And so I tried to put people inside the car or from Berkowitz's point of view, but every time, man, it scared the shit out of me, right? Just hearing it and editing. Just you're sitting there, then there's this sudden explosion of violence and glass and out of nowhere. It just, man, it's tough to.
Well, I was thinking how you thought about that too, which you answered just now, but I felt the same way as the actor going into it, because I'm reading these articles and reading the specifics of how things went down, and I got chills just going through that kind of research, because it put me, you know, especially when you're doing something for like a voice role or whatever, an acting role, you know, you really have to put yourself in the shoes of someone, especially that's if it's biographical or whatever, but you want to get the specifics down. So it's like, how did I feel inside the car? How would I have felt if this had happened? How would I have felt if this had done this act? And that part really scared me. And you sort of have to, you know, not judge it and just hit the off switch and then just proceed on, you know, but getting into that mind was very, very interesting. You know, I didn't know how I would feel with it.
Well, I want to get to more of that in a second, because,
because
it was risky on my part, but not really. What I like doing with voice actors coming in on parts, I like working with people that I trust. So I don't have to direct them, because I didn't really direct you at all on this.
I maybe asked for a couple of notes, but you were basically giving me freelance.
Because I knew that you are from the area, right? And that you'd say, oh, I knew motherfuckers like this, right? Like, oh, totally. I knew guys like Berkowitz who were a little awkward or who were a little, you know, or from the Bronx or, you know, all that kind of shit.
100%.
There was so much meat on the bone with this guy that you could get into. And then all of that, just all of the psychosis and him, you know, being adopted and wanting to find his real mother and the military and drug use. And he's one of the guests that I interviewed referred to him as being a nest of pathology. Okay. So as an actor, I can imagine how interesting that must have been to jump into. But what I want you to put me in the place, in the actor's headspace of being a murderer that honestly believes he's being commanded by like an evil force, right? Like, was that something that you factored in? Because that's a weird place to go.
100%. I mean, when I was first starting acting, I've always had a natural ability, but I never had an ingrained trained ability with a bag of tools. And so before all this, it would have been very difficult for me. But now that I went and got the training that I needed that was safe for me, I can go into a safe headspace. So for instance, when I was digging into something like this, I really had to go into, okay, I think the first thing I told myself was, after writing everything down, I'm like, okay, here are the facts. I need to stick to the facts. And then after that, I said, okay, what impediments does this, you know, person have? And by impediment, I mean, okay, is he a sociopath? What does that mean? What are the qualities of a sociopath? Okay, does he have ADHD or whatever the case may be? But I had to get into the headspace of, okay, what is this person? What mindset is he in at that point? And how can I connect myself to that mindset in some way where it's still myself, but I'm now portraying someone else?
And what did you come up with his mindset?
Well, I dug into a lot of stuff about psychology. You know, he wasn't in the right mindset. You know, there was stuff I read where he was on, you know, some hallucinogens. Mm. Okay, so that those take different qualities on how you act and how you feel. So, for instance, that first letter, I think it was the first letter where he's kind of, you know, jumping all over the place, even how it's written down. I said, okay, you know, this is going to be quite a challenge. But as I got into that mental state where it's like, okay, how can I connect myself to something like this? Okay, I say to myself, great. He is not in the right headspace, and maybe it's something that relates to being tired. Okay, let me see how I feel by trying that out. Mm. And I, you know, video myself up and see if I like it. And then if I'm not in that same motion or in that same mind, then I can't connect to it. But I have to find something that I relate to that gets the job in.
So a couple of questions. One, what do you think his primary motivating factor was? And two, do you think that he honestly believed that he was being commanded by a demon?
That's a twofold thing. So the stuff about the demon, when I was reading it and how he was committing the acts and he was saying to himself that he was possessed, I was like, you know, to kill someone, okay, to actually take someone's life away. And I've talked to like Marines and I've talked to people in the military, and they have a one-way answer where it's, if I'm being attacked forcefully, there's no other thing that I'm going to do. He's going to be taken out because my life is in danger.
Right.
It's a one-way way of thinking. So I said, you can't really be, the way he was committing those acts was very calculated. So it's, to me, it's saying, was he really possessed by someone? And then I'm not a big believer in possessions and stuff. You know, I believe in God, of course, but it's like, I don't believe that somebody can physically be embodied and possessed to do an act. I feel like it has to come from a place where you kind of consciously know what you want to do. And then you just kind of either blame it on something else or you take drugs or something like that happens. And as I read afterwards, I believe it was the new articles or the new interviews he had in 1990 where he said, you know, that was total false. I made it up, you know? And so going with that piece of knowledge that I had, I would say no. But if, let's say I'm now in 1970s and I'm now trying to get into the mind of him, I'd be a little terrified of saying, okay, maybe he's possessed. Cause you know, you have movies coming out like you so vividly expressed during that time. You have Taxi Driver and what, The Exorcist at that time. And you start to get into the mind of like, oh, this is kind of scary. Maybe it could be real. But once the facts are laid out, I felt to myself that no, it was probably like an intent. And, you know, he was either hallucinating or, you know, when you have that deep rooted, I don't know, it's like a deep rooted anger or a deep rooted self-worth that you're trying to prove. It just goes beyond your exterior. It's always going to be sitting within you. Mm-hmm. For instance, it's like, you know, who was my real father? Was he a good guy? You know, why did my parents split up? You know, and I've gone through divorce as a young kid. And I think to myself, well, why did that happen? You know, as you get older, you start to piece things together. And you're like, oh, maybe this person wasn't happy. But for him, it was very volatile. He was adopted, you know, didn't know who his real mom or dad was, found out later on, and then found out that, you know, one didn't want him. And that takes a real big toll, especially when you're not in the right mental state. And especially when, you know, you've just come out of the military and you're kind of failing at every, you know, life task that you're going after. It begins to be very depressing. And so the connecting factor is I really got into the mind of how someone was when they're depressed. And, you know, I've been in that state of mind before. And in order to get out of it, you kind of feel like there's this black hole always hovering over you. So I said, okay, that's where the training comes in, where I said, okay, I'm not in that headspace anymore, but let me go into that headspace again in a safe way so that I can portray this character well. So I was like, okay, depression, click that. That made sense. And I said, what else from there? Let me layer things on. Okay, how would I feel to not have a mom or not know where my mom is? How would I feel to fail at everything I've ever went after and not have a goal? How would I feel, you know, being rejected by women constantly, or having the need to want to be with a woman and then being rejected over and over and over again? That, along with depression and along with a bad mental state, creates havoc, you know, as we've seen.
So that's interesting that you say a lot of things there. And I'm going to do a separate episode on what I'm about to bring up, because I disagree a little bit with regard to the veracity of his beliefs at the time. In the I think my opinion of it is that because of everything that you just said, because of perhaps his drug use, because of his depression, because of his fear of abandonment again, or the utter hatred of the truth of his own conception. Okay.
Yeah.
Juxtaposed against his newly kind of forged Christian belief structure, right? That he had adopted, he had converted to evangelical Christianity. Yeah. Okay. Which, you know, very much believes in the power of demons and power of possession. I'm on your side. I don't really believe in it either.
Yeah.
And so then, but then how do I square that with obviously his admission in the early 90s that, I made it all up. Okay. And there is a little bit of, there's some precedent for that. There's serial killer precedent for that. Okay. With Ted Bundy. Okay.
Sure.
Ted Bundy, his youngest victim was like 12 years old, a 12 year old girl. Okay. And he never talks about it. He refuses. He never talked about it. He refused to even hint at it, but it's known. Okay. All of his other victims, he admitted to, but that the 12-year-old victim, intellectually, he wouldn't allow that to tarnish his reputation. Right.
That's interesting.
That's a bridge too far for him. He goes, no, I don't want to be thought of as a child killer. I'll kill adults. And I'll admit to it, and I'll be a fucking creep about it. And
sure,
right? But he wouldn't allow anyone to ask him questions about that 12. I think she was 12.
Do you think it was something that was motivated by ego, that like messed up his ego?
Yeah, I think it was all about how he would be perceived as a smart, kind of sophisticated killer. Okay. How that relates to Berkowitz, and again, I'm not an expert on this at all. But I just find the connection interesting, is that in jail, he had what he considers to be an actual conversion to Christianity, right? Discounting his previous conversion when in his 20s. In jail, he changed his name from Son of Sam to Son of Hope. And I think with that new kind of armor that he was wearing, right? That's what he was shielding himself with. And that's how he would explain, you know, why he didn't want parole. There were a lot of people in jail that he could help. He doesn't deserve parole. But at the same time, I don't think he could bring himself to admit demonic possession because he was such a good Christian. I think that was too, it was a bridge too far for him in his conversion, his jailhouse conversion. He didn't want to admit to it.
You know, you bring up a good point, because looking at it from an outside perspective of, you know, a writer that is creating something versus the actor that is, you know, doing the task of becoming, right?
Yeah.
I feel you bring up a good point where it's like, you know, could it possibly have been a persona? You know, because I'm looking at it from a perspective where I'm not going to go into it thinking that way.
Right.
But it's like, you know, could it have been a persona for him at that time? Because it even shows that relevance in the letters. When he's talking about it, and he wants people to be scared, and he wants to be known as the Son of Sam, and he wants to be feared, you know, and he wants to be hunted. I feel like he wanted to be hunted to the point where he was caught. And even when he was caught, it was like, all right, you got me.
Look, there's so many layers of this.
It's fascinating. It really is fascinating.
Psychosis and shit that I don't understand.
Yeah, it's better. I can see the appeal for public too.
Sure. Look, it's better for me, I think, to the story. It's better for the story if he actually believed he was being spoken to by a 6,000-year-old demon was telling him to go gather the blood of the pretty girls. It's better for the story. Okay.
Well, the way you tied that in was, it was quite horrifying to listen to, because it was in a mind where, you're listening to a medium of storytelling and you're like, you're frightened. You know, it brought me back to, I always bring up The Exorcist because that's the movie that scared me as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, they're speaking Greek in it too, which I understood.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the kind of horror that I feel like is, and here's the thing about me too, is that I don't necessarily like doing horror stuff because they're always so badly told.
Right.
But it's like, I knew that when you brought this, to me, I knew it was going to be done well because I've looked into your writing and stuff like that over the years, of course. And I was like, I know it's going to be good. And I wasn't disappointed because this is the kind of horror that's real and it tells you your story that happened.
Yeah. I'm constantly reminding people I'm not a journalist.
It's funny because it could come off like that, but it totally doesn't though. It comes off like a show.
Not a journalist. I'm a storyteller. Yeah. So, and I didn't want to say, oh, and by the way, he recanted all the demon stuff. Right. Because that would be right. And I also,
or he woke up and it was all a dream. Right, I hate that kind of stuff.
Because I also think that at the time, for whatever reason, and maybe he was making it up. Maybe he was making it up as a way to allow himself to continue doing it.
You nailed it. Yeah.
Right.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Absolutely.
Maybe. But either way, the guy was a fucking mess and he deserves the punishment that he's getting. And I think he should have been.
I mean, I'm almost fascinated because I've done work and research into like death penalty and that kind of stuff. But I mean, you start to think of, is he really reformed? Does prison work? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question yet. Some days I'm like, maybe it's better off. Some days I'm like, no, maybe he should have, paid the price for the lives that he took. But I don't really know. It's a tough one.
I think both can be true, right? Yeah. I wouldn't have batted an eye if I read everything about the Son of Sam. And then I read, and 8 years later, he was executed. I'd have been
sure. Yeah. It would be like, oh, cool. Of course.
He deserved it. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. I also, honestly, looking at his interviews over the last maybe 15 years, I actually think that he's reformed.
It's very consistent. It doesn't
really, dude. It yeah, really it, is. It really.
I was
is.
Almost shocked because I think the first interview I saw of him was his reform, and I looked at it and I said, "Oh my God. How am I going to even attempt to crawl into this world? This guy looks so normal now.
Remorseful, completely aware of everything that he did.
Feels like he should stay in prison, has denied. It's fascinating. Yeah. That part is really fascinating. These things. So maybe it did work.
I know. It's strange. It's strange because he doesn't come off as some moron. He's he's an intelligent guy.
Yeah, very intelligent.
He engages.
I think his IQ is very high as well.
Yeah, he thinks deeply about things. He obviously thought very deeply about parole and what it would mean to survivors and to him and to society as a whole. And he wrote a very well-reasoned letter to Governor Pataki, against his own best interests,
That was wild reading that.
Man.
But I mean, you bring up a good point tying again with Ted Bundy is that, maybe he got to the point where, because I read something in those, in the letters he wrote to his psychiatrist that they became really good friends. And I dug really deep into that. It was a lot of long, couple hundred pages, but the ones that I picked out most that stick in my mind was what tied in with what you said is that he doesn't like to talk about that part of him because it's so far in his past. He doesn't know who that person is anymore.
And can't we all relate to things like that?
That's what I think grasped me the most out of this whole thing is, I can absolutely relate
100%.
You don't do the same things that you did as a young kid. And I've done some really adolescent, silly, stupid,
no, of course.
Fucking things,
So many.
But it's like.
So much. Yeah.
To the point where I think there's a choice there.
There's that Pearl Jam song, Elderly Woman Behind the Counter in a Small Town. And there's a great line in it.
One of my favorite bands of all time.
I've changed by not changing at all. Okay. Those are the people that stand out. people that I haven't seen since high school that are doing the exact same thing or the exact same person. I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on? How have you not changed at all? So yes, I can relate to an unrecognizable person from my past who happens to be me, you know, that I'm not.
I'm telling you, Brandon, when I moved from LA back to New York, I had some growing pains. Okay. And the growing pains were very much along the lines of this, where I felt I literally went back to the same neighborhood I grew up in. Okay. Nothing changed. Okay. From the people that I have known, from the, stores or bodegas that are still there. And it's like the only unchanged place, because, you know, the gentrification came into Park Slope first, then Cobble Hill, where I grew up. And then after that, it just kind of spread out, but it really hadn't surfaced in the Bay Ridge area. And for people that don't know, it's right by the Verrazano Bridge, okay, that connects Staten Island. But, you know, it was fascinating for me because I started to get these growing pains of like, I'm not the same person. And it was really hard for me to fit in. And I never thought that would happen in the city I grew up in.
Yeah.
But after I sort of processed that over a couple of years, you start to realize, you know, that some people just are okay with being the same, you know, and not evolving. And for me, I knew for myself right then that it was always something of an evolution for me. I wanted to evolve. So this could be the case for him as well. You know, maybe it's something where in prison, that's the evolution of him in some way.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. A lot of people these days are charging into the new year, full of confidence and passion and big ideas and gym memberships and diet plans. And maybe that's you. And it's okay if it's not you. Because a lot of us are still searching for that better version of ourselves. The new year can be a difficult time. As I've said many times over the past few seasons of this show, I've been in therapy on and off for my entire adult life. And one of the main things I've learned is that massive change happens in small steps. Maybe ditch the extreme resolutions and take a small step towards a better you. BetterHelp offers online therapy. After they learn a little bit about you, you'll get matched with a licensed therapist for sessions that fit your schedule. BetterHelp is flexible, convenient, and if you're not happy with the therapist you're paired with, you can switch for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/devilwithin today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/devilwithin. Something else I want to get into. In the intro, I mentioned that you are an athlete, and I think people will find interesting the type of athlete you are, which is very specific, that you are a bodybuilder, a competitive bodybuilder.
I am.
And so, tell me about that, how you got into that, and how, if at all, it relates to your acting kind of method as well.
Yeah, absolutely. As for acting, I had went to a conservatory called William Esper Studio, and they teach Meisner technique. And so that was a vigorous 2-year program. You can kind of get kicked out whenever they feel like you're not working in the correct way. But regardless of that, that was a foundation. Now, going to the bodybuilding, I would say it changed my life and it set the course for my life. I've always grew up with the golden age of bodybuilders. Arnold Schwarzenegger was my hero, still is. And, you know, it was something about the aesthetic that was sort of sexy, you know, and I've always put these pictures on my wall. And I remember the first time I talked with one of my friends in Belgium, his name's Kevin, but he was like saying, you know, oh, you might know Jean-Claude Van Damme. And I kind of freaked because this guy was on my wall of a body that I wanted to have, or Arnold Schwarzenegger was on my wall as a body to have. And just that aesthetic was very appealing. And I started lifting weights at like 17 years old because I played basketball and I wanted to get a better jump shot. And I just didn't want to be around the same friends that were doing the same stuff. You know, they were either doing drugs in a house that I didn't want to be a part of because I'd never done anything before. And I didn't want to be, I saw the course and the trajectory of what my life would be like staying in those houses all the time. So I got into a gym. And this big Lithuanian power lifter came up to me and he goes, no, you should compete. And I said, what is that? know, who is that? And he goes, this, you compete, you know, you lift heavy, you should compete. And I said, okay. I started researching. I just dove into my first contest in 2007. And after that, I just really loved it. You know, bodybuilding taught me discipline. It taught me work ethic, and it taught me failure. And that's one of the biggest things that I feel like a lot of people fight with a lot. And I still fight with it too, is that the fear of failure. And so what I mean by that is you go and lift a weight and you fail on it. Big deal. What happens? You know, if you're not going to be lifting crazy amounts of weight, you have a sparring, but it's like, what happens if you fail at something? It's not the end of the world. You take note to that, you evolve, you move on, and you change. So as I competed in more and more contests, I took a break in 2009. I won the championship for the NPC Federation for Bantamweight Division. And then I had to make a choice. I didn't want to go on steroids, and I didn't want to continue on a path of that because I've stayed natural my whole life. And so I took like a solid 10-year break. And the reason why I got back into it is because they brought in something called classic physique, which is a hark back to the golden era of bodybuilding. It's not mass monsters. It's not these, you know, like I said, it's an aesthetic, sexy appeal for a body where if I have clothes on, I look, you know, normal, hopefully semi-normal, right? But then, you know, you take your shirt off and you flex it. Where did that come from? You know, one of my biggest goals in life was always I wanted to become Mr. Universe and Mr. Olympia. And just like my hero, you know, I followed in these paths. And so those inspiring, motivating factors, there always has to be a goal for me. So another thing bodybuilding taught me is a goal and how to set a goal and how to go after one. Because I can't go in there and lift these heavyweights without a goal attached to it. It's boring. You know, it's not satisfying. There's nothing to achieve for. So yeah, you know, that translates to acting. Because it's like, okay, I've done that. What else can I do? How can I challenge myself? You know, going into theater, especially last year, you're in front of like 3,000 people. And it's like, this is one of my first biggest shows. And I'm very, very nervous. You know, I get anxiety and I have to go through my process. But once you get out there, it's like a joy. You're just like, oh, here we go. You know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. So, you know, all those qualities were really taught by bodybuilding. And I guess the fun fact is that when you called me for this, like, yeah, I got an idea for you. And then you pitched me this idea. And I was in Romania competing for Mr. Natural Universe.
Oh, that's great.
So that was the funny thing. So yeah, I'm going to be competing again in the Natural Universe in October. So I've been now I've been kind of training for that over again. But it's a joy. You know, I love it. And when I think this is for everything, whether it's acting, whether it's bodybuilding, or whether it's, I don't know, writing, where when you don't like it anymore and it doesn't become fun and you're not smiling, then it's time to move on, you know? And that's something that really I learned from all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it taught me discipline, you know, especially as you know, with scripts and stuff, you know, you have to do a lot of research. You have to be intelligent. You have to retain information. And all that was ingrained with, you know, lifting weights.
Taught you discipline. So was that something that was lacking in your life?
I would say so. You know, after my parents had split, I was about 12. And I went through this period of, you know, you're in Brooklyn and, you know, the world's your oyster now. And I didn't really have much parenting hovering over me. I mean, there of course was relatives like, are you okay? Are you safe? And my brother's a firefighter. So there was also that. He was always had an eye on me. But, you know, I had to sort of learn through that. And I think the morals of being in the gym and no, I don't want to miss this workout, or no, I want to keep progressing. Hey, if I go out and have a night of drinking and I get myself wasted, okay, how's it going to affect my training the next day? So I always thought about the consequence. So yeah, I mean, I think it wasn't necessarily a lacking of discipline. It was a lacking of direction. And then by default, discipline came into play because you have to be disciplined to do this kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, and I always tell people, and a lot of people don't quite understand, but it's either I'm 100 or nothing, you know, with anything I do. If I'm called on for a project, or if I'm interested in something, if I want to attain something, if I want to go for a championship, you know, I can't be 50% in and 50% out. It has to be 100 or nothing.
Yeah.
Because you're not devoting all your time. And then what's really the point of doing that? So yeah, I mean, the foundations were definitely drawn from that, from the time of being in the gym, because you have failure on a daily basis. And in order to see progress, you need the discipline. And so that translated to acting, of course, because it is vigorous. And if you want to be, you know, really, really great at something, not just to do it, just to say you do it, but to be really great at something and successful at something, I feel like you have to have that discipline, because without it, you're all over the place. You know, there's nothing that's giving you direction to go forward. You're going askew all the time.
What made you say no to steroids, with your heroes being people who built their bodies on it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, well, there's two parts to that. One part was I was terrified. Okay.
Of what?
Of any side effect.
Like your ball, you know, shrinking, like that kind of stuff?
Yeah. You know, even stuff like that, like your ball shrinking, or right, like, you know, your liver being double the size and it's irreversible. I've trained with guys that were on steroids my whole life. Okay. Yeah. And I think firsthand I saw, you know, these 17, 18 year old kids, massive guys. And I kid you not, I was training with a really good buddy of mine, and about a year later, you know, we were still training together, and he comes into the gym and he's like laughing, but he goes, "Hey, check this out. I have this really, really cool thing." And he shows me, not even kidding, a blood pack attached to his chest that's draining blood because he had a hematoma explosion from the side effect of steroids.
Wow.
And I said to myself, isn't bodybuilding about, you know, supposed to be about being in the best health and shape of your life?
Yeah.
Where did that go astray here? It's because it sells.
Right.
And that's the thing. These things sell. And so I said, I didn't want to be part of that market machine. I wanted to do it for myself. And myself is, it's being in the best fitness shape and the best health of your life.
Right.
I think that's why the drugs had scared me, you know, my whole life.
Yeah.
Is that I was just afraid to tamper with that. Plus, my dad would have given me a beating. That's for sure. But yeah, I think it was, you know, one thing was terror. And the other part was I didn't want to be a hypocrite. You know, I'm pretty straight edge when it comes to my life and my decisions and talking to people. And I've always wanted to be consistent with that. I didn't want to be something that was for show or for fake. And of course, you know, listen, we all do it. If I'm on the stage, it's showmanship. When I'm performing in theater, it's showmanship. But when it comes to being a human being, I wanted to be consistent with my morals. And that really was the thing that made me stick to saying I don't want to do this, is the morals and the fear.
Good for you. Whatever gets you there, right?
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
Fear's a strong motivating factor sometimes, you know?
It is.
Yeah.
You know, especially if something scares the shit out of you. You're like, I'd rather not go near it.
I could argue that it's a more powerful deterrent than a moral compass sometimes. Right?
Yeah.
Maybe. All right. Rapid fire. Ready? Best pizza.
Oh my God.
Don't think about it. Just fucking answer.
DeFaro's Pizza.
Where?
It was on East 18th and Avenue J. It's closed down now, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. If you had to get it, all right. In New York, any borough today, pizza, where would you go?
I'm going to be biased. It's Brooklyn.
Okay. All right. Great. All right, Marvel or DC?
Oh, totally Marvel.
Okay. Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
De Niro or Pacino?
Oh, Pacino.
Whoa!
Yeah, I know. It's they're both the people why I wanted to get into acting. Both of those guys do.
Breaking news. Just,
yeah, The Godfather is my number one favorite film of
all time. That's next. Godfather or Goodfellas?
Yeah.
Godfather. Wow.
And I love Goodfellas.
Same. Okay. I think I learned more about you in those questions than anything else. All right.
I also love Rocky and Jaws. I put those up there too. Shawshank Redemption, another one.
Sure. Yeah.
Classic.
Those are all, I mean, every movie that you just mentioned, I won't ever turn off, no matter what I'm doing.
For me, it's on. I'm there watching it.
I'll just stop what I'm doing and watch to the end of anything. Yeah, of anything. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So listen, Johnny, this has been awesome. I want you to tell listeners
fantastic, man. I love this.
Tell listeners where they can find you.
Yes, you can find me on my website. It's Johnny Kios, JohnnyKios.com. Or just, you know, you can find me on Instagram. It's John_Kioskerides, KIOSKERIDES. It's a Greek mouthful. but that's where you can find me. And I always respond to people because I like to be engaged.
Great. And anything coming up? You said you're going to be competing again soon in October?
Yeah. So I have, I'm right now tied to two theater shows in the DC area. So you could look out for that. It's probably going to be from April onwards to about June. And then I have Mr. Universe in October, Mr. Natural Universe, and then I have Mr. Natural Olympia in Vegas in November. So if you're around, you can come see some cool stuff.
I'm going to be in Vegas in March to see Springsteen. But
oh my God, that guy just kills my heart, man. Yeah, right? I'm always listening to him.
Well, I can say from experience that if you haven't been to a bodybuilding competition, one, you should go.
It's so much fun.
A, for the holy shit factor of it, right? Because you really don't know what you're into. You've seen
pictures. You have no idea until you actually see it happen.
You don't know how much of a, how performative of an art it is.
Yeah.
That scared me and shocked me. And I went, this is really hard.
Did you feel inspired afterwards?
I felt.
Or like defeated?
No, not defeated. It's weird what I felt.
Okay, good.
I was just really, really surprised. I was like, yeah. I had no idea how dedicated you had to be as a performer to get through this. The level of confidence required is through the fucking roof. Okay. And the care and the craftsmanship that the athletes take with their own bodies as their canvas is, I'm telling you, it's breathtaking. You're like, I can't believe people are able to do this to themselves.
Well, the funny thing I will say is that, you know, I'm very like shy as a person. Okay. And you talk to my acting coach, it's like, you know, fucking shy, Johnny, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, you know, there's this inner part of me where I do fear going out on, you know, on stage and stuff, but it's the work that you've already done where you're just like, you know, this is it, you know, enjoy this moment. You know, it's like being on a set. You've done the work already. There's not really much you're going to alter without obviously direction from your director, but it's like, you know, this is the point. This is the time to have fun.
Yeah. But here's the
difference. That's how I look at it.
Here's the difference. Ready?
Yeah.
99.9% of the time you walk out onto a set, you're not 99.9% fucking naked. Right.
Okay. Or in a little tiny Speedo trunks.
A little Speedo. Right. And you're oiled up and you're like completely saying, here I am naked. Judge me.
Yeah.
Like that's
plus
what
backstage it feels like conversation is as normal as this. You're having like a cup of coffee talking over topics and everyone's like either naked or half naked
and getting oiled up by another
it's amazing. I was being oiled up for one of the shows and I had the Team Grease coach there and he was like just having a conversation with me. He goes, yeah, how are you feeling today? I'm like, oh, I'm feeling pretty good. And I'm like, can you bend down real quick? Oh, okay, no problem. Yeah. So what did you do last night?
I'm telling you.
Awesome. It's just, I love it.
It's a world that that not a lot of people know exists, or if they know it exists, they don't really know the particulars. And it's worth investigating because fascinating. Fascinating.
I wholeheartedly agree with that, you know, and I want to make sure that people can understand that, you know, you can do it if you want to. It's not something unattainable. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, man. Yeah, come visit a show. And I'll add on to that. You know, Brandon, this has been a joy to work with you. The project that you've created has been really fantastic. It's, you know, it's another thing to be part of a good, you know, role, but it's another thing to be part of good writing. And that's the main thing that I always look for. And once you have that, it's just golden, man. So thank you. Man, I appreciate you, brother.